That's Segundo here, and I'm glad we've finally returned this show to its regular format. Singing tenors? What next? A 60-piece orchestra of helper monkeys? A juggler? A trapeze artist? A third-rate stripper? That wouldn't be so bad. Well, anyway, I have talked with the producers, and they assure me that the three cheap tenors won't be returning anytime soon, in part because they want the same pay rate as me. They have now been blessed in my eyes, the three somewhat inexpensive tenors. Although, perhaps the three opportunistic tenors, or perhaps the three carpet-bagging tenors might be better. None of this, of course, has anything to do with this week's guest, a writer named Julia Glass. I've never been to this Bank Street she writes about, but if things continue the way they do here at Segundo HQ, I'll need to be talking with my bank. Oh dear, I think they have me on that blacklist at the welfare office.
So I am here with Julia Glass, author of the National Book Award-winning Three Junes, as well as The Whole World Over. Julia, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Ed. How are you?
Pretty good. I accidentally mispronounced your title before, but now I've got it straight. What is the story behind the title?
Well, there's a long story behind the title, The Whole World Over. Originally, my book was called A Piece of Cake.
Uh-huh.
And it was called that for 4 years, and although I'm not a title person, it's one of those titles that came to me right from the start in a playful way, in part because the book begins with a certain person eating a certain piece of cake, and in a way all the events of the novel unfold because of that one culinary action. Mm-hmm. But of course there's all the irony in the expression a piece of cake and its relationship to finding true love and how hard that is. But in part for marketing reasons, and then because there was a memoir that came out in February with that same title, we had to make a last-minute scramble for this title. And everyone at my publisher and I started tearing through poems, singing torch songs, doing somersaults to try to find the right title. And then I found a passage in the book in which a character named Saga, who has been kind of, her life's been a bit derailed by a head injury, is examining a bird watching poster of migration routes all over the world. And she looks at the poster and all these ribbons that represent the migrations of these birds and meditates on how birds fly thousands and thousands of miles, but they all come home in the end. They come back to roost in the same place. And she speculates about what it means to be, as she calls it, a roving homebody. And in my mind, that embodied the way in which we search so hard and so far and wide for not just our place in the world, but our soulmates, our true families. So I thought, okay, that works. But it's actually proven to be a difficult title for people to remember. So it is The Whole World Over.
Yeah, for some reason I thought it was The World Once Over, and I had read the book from
start
to finish.
I like that title too.
Well, speaking of A Piece of Cake, well, there's one other thing. I was wondering, first of all, if that Marie Antoinette came to mind when you did that.
Let them eat cake.
No,
I hadn't thought of her, although I think she's actually mentioned in this book in passing.
Well, the other thing, too, is that there is a considerable amount of attention paid to food in this book, and I know you have a background in journalism, so I'm wondering, I have to ask, what came first, sort of a chicken and the egg argument? Was it the food or the greenie character?
You're the first person to ask me that. In a way, both at once. Every piece of fiction that I write begins with a single character. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that single character has to get in some kind of trouble. As the writer John Dufresne says, and I love to quote this, fiction is only about trouble. And as you and I were discussing before this interview, fiction writers tend to be rather sadistic because they spend their working lives getting people in trouble.
Yeah.
And then hopefully out again. I like to get people out of trouble, too. But I conceived of this character, and I'll talk about her in a minute if you like, but I also found myself sitting in a car in a traffic jam as the passenger, knowing that I should not start a conversation with the driver, who is my partner, because conversations in traffic jams only lead to altercations. And I was experiencing an incredible craving for a particular piece of coconut cake that I had tasted that week in a restaurant in New York. And I was also trying to drum up this new character, and I'd had a hazy notion of this woman. And I thought, what if this woman is a pastry chef and she makes these extraordinary cakes? And what if a stranger comes to town and orders a piece of her cake? And as a result, all hell breaks loose. So that's what I did. I mean, it was kind of just a funny, serendipitous thought I had, and it took root.
Oh, okay. Well, also, there's Fenno, who's the holdover from Three Junes, and I was wondering, did the whole world over begin as its own separate entity, or did the Bank Street sort of tie-in occur as you were writing the book?
I never intended to have any of the characters from Three Junes return in this book. Mm-hmm. I admire many writers who return again and again to the same settings and the same characters, but I never saw myself doing that. I hadn't done it in any of my short stories, and I was writing in the same world, that little niche of the West Village that I use in Three Junes. That's very much Fenno's world in Three Junes. And Greenie Duquette and her husband, Alan, live on that street, and she makes desserts for a restaurant on that street that is run by Walter Kinderman, who becomes an important character in the book as well. And because I envisioned so exactly the location of that restaurant, and it happened to be on the exact same block as Plume, which is Fenno McLeod's bookstore in Three Junes, I had a moment where I thought, well, they would know him. They would go to that bookstore. And I played with it. But as I was playing with it, as I was bringing him into the story, I thought, this is probably a security blanket of some kind. But I can write him in, and I can write him out again.
Yeah.
But I never did, and I felt that actually he belonged in the story.
Well, given the allusion to Faulkner in Three Junes, I figured this was your own way of creating a Yoke Napatafa kind of county situation.
No, I'm not up to that yet. Yes, Bank Street.
Yeah, exactly. An urban Yoke Napatafa. No, there's an interesting female-centric emphasis in your books that I find very interesting. There's three-dimensional women that often have more going on, I think, than your male characters. I mean, even a brief supporting character like Joya, who is Alan's sister, has this major kind of epiphany of like wanting to have a child in her scenes in the book. I don't want to give too much away, but I'm wondering if you're more interested in writing about women in their 30s to combat this kind of onslaught about all of the so-called male menopause novels, or and why does every character in this book pine for a child almost? I mean, certainly this isn't everyone's motivation in life.
Well, everyone doesn't pine for a child in this novel, despite what some critics have had to say, but there is a lot of yearning toward making a family with a new generation, I'll put it that way. It's interesting that you should see my fiction as female-centric because, and I'd love to discuss that because I'm a female, but most people remark on how many more male characters there are and how much stronger my male characters are. Oh. And when I decided to write the character of Greenie Duquette, and now I'll talk a little bit about her character, I was actually trying to combat the notion that I was stronger in my writing of male characters than of female characters, which was generally the response that I got to Three Junes. So I wanted to create a very strong female character. I also wanted to create a character who was very different from Fenno McLeod, because I thought, and bear in mind that I started this book before Three Junes was even published. So fortunately, I didn't feel the pressure of following the National Book Award at that point by any stretch of the imagination. But I did want to avoid writing my first novel a second time. So I thought I would do something I had never done, which was to write about a protagonist who's basically a happy person, mm-hmm. who's always known what she wanted to do, has achieved success in that ambition, has married the man she loves, she has had a wonderful child, she has this very precocious 4-year-old son. But she's run up against a wall, and that wall is actually the withdrawal and the depression of her husband, over which she has no control. And she's somewhat, in her confidence, she's somewhat impulsive and even brazen, and she makes a decision that is in some ways a good decision. It's a good decision for her, but it has ramifications for the people around her, particularly her husband, that are not entirely positive. And when I was writing that part of the book, when she accepts the offer to go and become the chef to the governor of New Mexico, who is not Bill Richardson.
Far from
it. I found myself thinking about Jane Austen's Emma, mm-hmm. a character who is very likable but very aggravating, and whose very virtues are also her Achilles heel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her way of wanting to orchestrate the lives of people around her with her enormous intelligence. And Greeny is a little bit like that. So I'm glad that I've created a strong female character. I will say that a lot of people seem to be very captivated also by Saga, who was a very difficult character for me to write, who is the woman I referred to before, who's had a head injury 4 years in the past and is having problems with her memory and feels that she's unable to live on her own. So she's living with an older uncle and she's rescuing animals, and her life intersects with that of Greeny's husband. So I feel that in this book I gave much more weight to female sensibilities. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm not averse to hearing that maybe my female characters are even stronger than the men.
I found it just odd because it was very interesting to me that you take the omniscient narrator approach, and yet you have characters remarking more upon Alan, whereas, you know, Greeny is kind of left to kind of, you know, commit her mistakes unchecked, with the exception of Ray kind of intervening later in the book. And I found that to be a very interesting decision on your part, because it sort of was like, you know, why isn't she kind of being upbraided as much as Alan is? I mean, Alan certainly has like these neuroses, but simultaneously it's like, you know, they're both, you know, I guess they've committed just as unethical in their own respective ways. You know, one could argue that.
Unethical is a little puritanical, Ed. I think that they commit folly. They certainly do. You know, I was just in the gym and I was listening to Al Green while I was trying desperately to, you know.
And you're wearing green, too. Green
yes,
is a
I am
theme
Al
here.
Green.
Yeah.
Green. Yeah. Yes, I am a green person, and you're wearing green.
Yes, I am.
We are both wearing green stripes, Ed and I, in some strange, odd moment of, what do you call that?
Serendipity?
What's that word? It begins with an S. Back to the book.
Yeah.
So I was listening to this song that I love, this Al Green song, Love and Happiness, and he, you know, it starts out saying, he sings, and I certainly won't try to imitate the great Al Green, but, you know, he kind of murmurs, you know, love and happiness, something that'll make you do right, something that'll make you do wrong, something that'll make you stay out, what is it, stay out all night. I actually have written it in the front of my book because it'll make you come home early, make you stay out all night long. And I thought, wow, you know, in a way, that should have been the epigraph for this novel, because all the characters act out of love. They betray and hurt one another. But this is probably a much more romantic novel than Three Junes. I don't know if you would see it that way, but I do, because I think it's much more straightforwardly about looking for true love.
I guess, though, going back to this question of the omniscient narrator, I mean, it just seemed to be more commentary for Alan. I mean, and by unethical, I suppose I was suggesting sort of flaws that these characters make, not to necessarily pass judgment, but it seems like that the you have a lot of characters remarking upon the mistakes that Alan makes over, you know, and not so much on the mistakes that Greeny makes. And
I see what you're saying, yeah. And I was actually talking to somebody yesterday about a realization I've had about the difference between these characters that would seem pretty obvious, but somehow in reading from the book and in choosing passages to read, I've noticed that Alan and Saga, the other female character in the book, are deeply introspective characters, and they make most of the observations that they make in this book are directed toward their interior. Although Saga also makes a lot of observations of the outside world, because she's constantly trying to make reality checks because of her memory problems. But they always bounce back again off her interior. She's kind of like a bat. I was thinking, you know, because bats use that, what is it, echocollation, where they send out signals that bounce off the outside world. And that, in a way, is how Saga's part of the narrative proceeds. But Greeny is a much more outwardly directed person, and so is Walter, the other main male character. They both live and work in very gregarious worlds. They feed people, they entertain people, and they're not so introspective. So if it seems that there's more judgment passed on Alan, perhaps, or that I'm harder on him, it's not that. It's that he's much harder on himself than Greeny is on herself. And it's interesting that you would call the narration omniscient, because to me it's... I'm not writing in first person the way I did for most of Three Junes. Yeah. That was something else I wanted to do differently. But in each of the four character sections, you're inside their head. So I guess I think of it as, you know, third person limited, is I think what my high school English teachers called that. So you see the world through the eyes of that character only, for that character's part of the narration. But there are four points of view. And Greeny is very harsh on her husband. Or that's not true. She's very impatient with him. But that has to do with her own nature.
But so is Walter, too. Walter just totally rips Alan. I mean,
He does, but Alan isn't his kind of guy. There's no chemistry there. He can't understand how anybody could be such an agonizer. Walter is a man who's seized life for many reasons. He's a gay man who's led a very colorful life, and yet he's gotten off. Mm-hmm. He's a survivor. He appreciates it. He had a difficult childhood. He lost both of his parents, and he's always been angry at his father. He was raised by a grandmother whom he idolizes, and he seized life. Mm-hmm. And he looks at Alan as this waffler, a guy who is lying back on a couch, he's a psychotherapist, but who is taking the blows and not standing up, fighting for the woman he loves. Walter is, even though he's gay, he's a little bit in love with Greeny, you know? And he wants her to be happy. And he sees this husband in a total funk. And he thinks, as people often do who try to see into a marriage, what's the guy's problem?
Yeah.
Why doesn't he embrace and love and show affection to this woman?
I was curious if Alan was kind of like a commentary off of a particular type of... there's been a lot of like literature and films of late that have tried to sort of... depict the sort of person over 30 who hasn't actually made a decision in their life and is basically sitting around doing nothing. Was this kind of like a generational sort of commentary on your part that you did through Walter and through Greeny to some degree? Or?
Well, I will say this, and I hope I won't get myself ostracized from the tribe of female writers my own age whom I love. But, I've noticed, and I've been invited to participate in a lot of essay collections that are focused very much on midlife, as we baby boomers hit midlife, woe is us, or these litanies by my female peers on how women's liberation promised us a certain kind of relationship, a certain kind of egalitarian world, and we didn't get it, men are insensitive pigs after all, and I think that, I mean, this is a bit of a cliche, but I think it's true to say that our generation hasn't really been tested by much. As angry and annoyed as I can get at my own parents, they lived through, the Depression, and my father had a father who fought in World War II. My father wasn't old enough to fight. But we live a very easy life. And so we nitpick about things. And, I'm somebody who's enjoyed extraordinary good fortune in the past few years. There's no doubt about it, professionally speaking. But I'm also someone who's faced compromises in my expectations about love and happiness, to quote Al Green again. But that's part of life. I mean, what do you want? You think you're going to get everything? And I think in some ways, in all my fiction, I'm always trying to make digs at that. However, I do love the character of Alan, and in some ways, his agonizing nature is a bit my own. Or let's say I used to be more of an agonizer. I just turned 50, and there isn't much time left for agonizing. But I do think that we should embrace our lives with all the imperfections they hold more fervently than we do. We should forgive more. I don't think we're a terribly forgiving generation. I'm not sure that's even the word I'm searching for. But when I create characters, I'm often thinking about their lives in relation to the way that I'm perceiving my peers and I, you know, living our lives at this point where we've suddenly hit the half century mark. Yeah. And all these characters are about that age. I Three Junes was had a more multicultural, not multicultural, that was a slip, a more multi-generational cast of characters than this book does. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it wasn't until I was probably halfway through that I noticed, and again, these are the obvious things that you'd think authors would notice, but I sometimes miss them, that of my four major characters, if you looked at all their parents, only one was still living. In other words, three of these characters had already lost both of their parents, and one, Alan, had lost one parent. And that was striking to me. And I think that at some subconscious level, I was also writing about what happens when we become the front-running generation in our families.
Well, I was going to actually ask you about this because there's a lot of sort of multipliers of themes. You have lots of dogs, you have lots of kids, you have lots of unexpected pregnancies. Are you a writer who kind of works and operates more in terms of having multiple sort of indicators of one motif? Or?
Well, my novels are full of multiples of everything. Yeah. They're just, you know, they're like those closets you don't dare open because everything's going to spill out on the floor and give you a concussion. I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine when we were in our late 30s, and he said to me, you know, our lives were very chaotic. And he said, didn't you sort of think that life was going to get simpler at some point? And I said, you know, I guess I did, but it doesn't, does it? He said, no, it just gets more and more and more complex. And that's true. It does. And I think my fiction gets more and more jam-packed with passions and longings and I guess pets and babies. But I do think that what happens, and you talked about how many babies and pregnancies there are in here. Are there really a lot of unwanted pregnancies?
Well, unexpected
pregnancies.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm not going to quibble with that. I have to think. But yes.
No.
So, but again, when you become a member of the, as I called it, the front-running generation, you begin to look at those younger than you, and you also begin to look to your own life as a parent, or if you haven't become a parent, as a potential parent. Are you going to become a parent? Or are you not going to become a parent? I mean, there is one couple in this book, a gay couple who have been together for 13 years, and one of them has he has come to the decision that it's very important to him to be a father. And his partner doesn't want that. He wants to, you know, keep their life as it is, and it's a very nice life. And they, you know, their patience of Alan, Greeny's husband, who's a couples counselor. But, you know, I think what I wanted to say is that everybody who leads a really full and passionate life has to confront that issue at some point. You can't ignore it. If you make a decision that you don't want to have children, that's one thing. But all these people are at that age. And so I didn't sit down and think, well, let's have everybody facing the baby issue. It came naturally to me because I felt that all these characters are you know, deeply intelligent, passionate people. And so it's going to be one of the issues they face at this time in life.
There's one also thing I wanted to talk to you about, and that is this balance you have in your books of wry, very closely observed human behavior versus a kind of larger, almost, you know, I don't want to use the term melodrama, but it's sort of, I guess, larger kind of story motif like AIDS or September 11th, which comes into play in this mm-hmm. book, or someone who loses their memory. And I'm wondering about this because, you know, like someone like James Wood would argue, oh, well, you know, literature should be entirely about, you know, naturalism. And you're a very sort of naturalistic writer in the way that you actually observe behavior. And I wanted to, you know, ask you why some of these kinds of, you know, I guess, larger story arcs actually appear in your work. Are these sort of a way for you to kind of keep the story moving? Or maybe you can talk about this.
They usually, I think what you're talking about is the way in which my imagined world, yeah. the interior lives of my characters, merges with the real timely world, the historic moment that we live in. And most of those themes or issues, whether they're AIDS or September 11th, enter the lives of my characters in the way that they've entered my life. I don't write, or at least I should say, the two novels that I've written are not based on autobiographical events, but they're very much based on autobiographical emotions and experiences in the larger sense of the word. And I have to say, I admire fiction writers who can bring contemporary morality and politics to bear in a psychological context. And I was brought up by a father, a very proper father, who told me that it was not polite to talk about politics. I was actually taught that you avoid talking about politics, and if you're at a party or somewhere else and someone starts to talk about politics, you either try to change the subject or you agree completely with whatever they're saying until they're so bored they change the subject. So when something like AIDS or September 11th or water conservation, which is something that comes into this book, water conservation in the Southwest, enters this book, I think I always have this little red light that starts blinking in my head and telling me, oh no, it's politics. But it's life too. Yeah. And, you know, September 11th does come, you know, the events of September 11th do have an effect on the lives of my characters because I did not intend to include September 11th in the book when I started it for the simple reason that I started the book in April of 2001. Mm-hmm. And what I knew about this book is that it was about this group of characters who live mainly in New York City, and it was going to cover the years 2000 and 2001. Well, I had written probably 100 pages of the book when there I was living in Lower Manhattan on September 11th, and the towers were struck by the planes. And I experienced what I think a lot of fiction writers experienced at the time, which was a sense of purposelessness in what I did. What is the point of writing made-up stories? It seems so tiny, so trivial. And I couldn't write fiction for a couple of months. And then when I did kind of force myself to return to the fiction, I had not just the problem of feeling once again that what I did mattered a great deal, but I had this plot issue, and I could have made the decision to set the book in 1999 and 2000 or in Tulsa, Oklahoma, but I thought, no, I'm going to write forward, and when I get to that point in the book, I'll know what to do. And I think what I came to do in the end was to face the events of September 11th in the lives of my characters as they had affected my own life. In many ways I was spared, but in many ways I was quite directly affected by living there and then. And to turn away from that would have been cowardly and disingenuous. And I take exception to the critics nowadays who make snide remarks about how many fiction writers are using 9/11 opportunistically to advance the plots of their stories. And you know, that may be true, but most of the books I've read that incorporate either the events of that day or the effects, the lasting effects of that day, like Saturday by Ian McEwan, are books that are about how our personal psyches and our cultural psyche have changed. You know, those events added a wing to the house of my soul. Yeah. And to ignore that would have been like leaving a foundation open in the rain and not to build the part of the house that belongs over it. So yet, you know, it is, I mean, 9/11 is only the last, 70, 80 pages of the book. Yeah. I mean, this book is really about, you know, four people struggling with love and mortality and procreation and the way they see their parents, and then they happen to be in New York City on that day.
But isn't there something to be said for understatement? Like, for example, to name another book that actually found a very creative way to use September 11th, Tom Perrotta's Little Children. I'm not sure if you read this, but
I did read that. Yeah. I found that book highly entertaining, but and he chose to include it in his way. And by the way, I mean, I don't know Tom Perrotta, but, I was going to say, you know, he I don't think he lives in New York City, but that doesn't mean it's not as much his to claim and that he couldn't write about that. But I suspect, having read that book, that he was doing the same thing I was, that he was writing about, he was folding the effects of that day on his life into the lives of his character. I think it affected them the way that it affected him. And I have written about my characters as, I suppose, surrogates for myself in their experience of that day and its mental and moral repercussions.
But if you're dwelling upon, like, very finely observed behavior, such as we were talking about the Allen and Greeny marriage, then doesn't, like, an event such as September 11th or some sort of mammoth overhanging kind of cultural, you know, phenomenon, doesn't this kind of take away from that? How do you manage with such a disparity between something utterly subtle and understated versus something, I guess, larger or, you know, sheets of paper flying through the air and the like?
Well, you know, it's very tricky. I mean, I will say this. The minute you insert a large historic event into a novel, particularly one that's recent, that you know that your readers were alive for, you know that lights are going to flash in the readers' heads. I mean, basically, the readers' own experience of that traumatic event are going to probably intrude on their reading of your book. But hopefully, that's only temporary, or it may seize their attention more fully. And if some readers feel, oh, come on, you know, I'm sick and tired of reading about September 11th, I read fiction to get away from that sort of event, then okay, you've lost some readers. But it's, you know, some people believe that you have to let large historic events ferment for quite some time before you can allow them to enter the fictional arena. And, you know, like the Vietnam War, let's say. I mean, I'm sure there was a lot of so-called Vietnam fiction that came out even during the Vietnam War and shortly thereafter. But I don't think you can say that there has to be some holding period for that. I was also discussing with some booksellers yesterday, what does it mean to write historic fiction? I know one writer whose characters experienced September 11th in her novel as well, and she believes that when she decided to do that, that suddenly she was writing a historic novel. Well, I disagree, because I think, in my mind, you're not writing a historic novel unless you're writing a novel that is set in a period that predates your memory. You know, I was born in the 1950s, but I could still write about the 1950s as historic fiction, because my first memories probably are around 1959, 1960. But after that, when my own memory and my own experience of life intersects with events, it's not historic fiction anymore. It's fiction within the realm of my own experience. And it, you know, again, I'll say it's risky, but I'm very glad that I did it. You know, I found writing those pages of the novel a very ambitious experience for me, and I had to pay extremely close attention to each character's experience and make sure that I wasn't simply spouting a lot of cliches, a lot of sort of revised memory, as it were, that's more collective memory than personal memory. I relied very heavily on my personal memories. And although I don't keep a journal, I had actually written some essays. I attempted some essays at the time. For instance, I wanted very, very much at the time to write about the conversations that I had to have with my five-year-old, who asked many, many questions. And, you know, there was no skirting the issues. And it's amazing. I would pick him up at the playground, and he and his friends would be discussing Osama bin Laden in the sandbox. And
which makes the way in the book, too.
It does. And I had written this essay, which, you know, never was published. I sent it to a couple places, and then I decided that I had written it mostly for myself. And it was about the way my feelings about being a mother changed so completely. My world was so... suddenly seemed so unsafe. But you know, how safe is your world at any time? I mean, a lot of this is relative, or it's an illusion. So I feel that the experience I went through as a writer to write that part of the book was very freeing for me. I felt that I had let go of a certain fear, my fear of politics entering my book, my fear of, you know, too much of the real world. And I feel, I feel that I grew as a writer. And, you know, and I think that part of the book succeeds for many people. And if it doesn't for others, then it doesn't.
Okay. I actually wanted to ask you about why you chose New Mexico over, say, Arizona or Nevada. I mean, aside from the whole Old Mexico, New Mexico thing, which I kind of thought. And also, you know, Ray McCrae is very much a sort of either... he's almost a Thomas Sutpin-esque kind of character. And I think there's actually one allusion to Faulkner early on in his description. But maybe you can describe how this kind of character came to be, because he's different from all the other characters in the sense that he's this just wildly exuberant sort of figure who pops up amidst all these kind of, like, you know, introspective turmoil.
Yes, yes. Well, he's let me tell you, I don't know anybody like Ray McCrae. I'll tell you that I chose New Mexico over Arizona and Nevada, because I've never been to Arizona or Nevada, but I've been to New Mexico. I wanted a setting that would really contrast to New York, and I wanted it to be somewhere I had been. And I had the idea of the character of this governor before I chose a state. And he's like the cowboy politician. Yeah. You know, I hate to say it, but there's a pinch of W in Ray McCrae, although I think he's a much smarter guy and a guy with more introspection, although he's a real extrovert. And I push the envelope. You know, there's a way in which at times I thought, he's almost a cartoon character. But I think some politicians are like that, too. I think people who lead very large public lives become sometimes caricatures of themselves. So there was no way this guy could be the governor of Vermont or, you know... Any other number of states that I might have chosen as distant and different from New York. And I like to write about places that I have loved. And, you know, I'm hardly alone in being utterly captivated by Santa Fe and the New Mexico landscape. And I also joke that I wanted to be able to take a trip to New Mexico and deduct the airfare, which I did. And I did get to have a tour of the public part of the governor's mansion in Santa Fe.
Yeah, how did you swing that? Because I noticed that you thanked Mrs. Richardson in your acknowledgments section.
I only got to meet Mrs. Richardson briefly, but it was thanks to her. Actually, the governor's mansion in New Mexico is open for a public tour. I think, you know, something like the first Tuesday of every month. But I couldn't orchestrate my trip to time it with that. And also, I wanted to be able to ask a lot of questions. And so I was... Actually, thanks to the help of a librarian at Widener Library at Harvard, where I was, I had a one-year fellowship to finish this novel, I was able to contact the mansion director, who I suppose would be the equivalent of the character Mary Bliss in here, who works for the governor and is also secretly in love with him. And I think they were a little mystified by me. I explained that I was writing a novel that was not a political satire, that there was a governor of New Mexico not based on Bill Richardson, that I'd won the National Book Award for this novel, Three Dunes, which I'm sure none of them had heard of or read. But they were nice to me. And so the mansion director, a lovely woman named Lorraine Rotuno, and a docent took me around the same parts of the mansion that basically anybody gets to see, but on my own, so that I could ask a lot of nosy questions. And then I did get to go into the kitchen. I'm not sure everybody gets to do that. And I got to shake hands with the chef, who is a woman, and the sous chef, who is also a woman. And I asked questions about how the governor entertains. I mean, I made decisions to invent details of my own. And I also made, you know, this governor is a bachelor governor, so he does not have a wife or children. and he has the habit of spending a short portion of every morning in the kitchen eating leftovers from dinner the night before and chats with Greeny, the chef. And I have no idea what Bill Richardson's habits are, but Barbara Richardson came out to meet me and shake hands with me, and we chatted. She actually was born and grew up in Massachusetts, as I was, and so we had a little chat. She grew up in a town right next to the town where I grew up, so you know, we were like, "What high school did you go to?" and all that. But the politics of New Mexico, as I conceive them here, are pretty fanciful. Not to say that I didn't. I actually subscribed to the New Mexican online, and I would read it, and I did do a lot of Googling about water rights issues. But a lot of that stuff hit the cutting room floor. You know, you end up shaving away a lot of the reality that you've so carefully researched, I think, when you're writing
besides,
a psychological novel.
Robert Towne already did it with Chinatown anyway, so.
Right, exactly. But it can't be discussed enough, actually. I think water is a resource that, you know, people don't discuss as much as they should. I mean, we talk a lot about oil, but water's the next big issue in this country, I think, after that. I mean, as far as natural resources go.
Sure. I want to talk about character names. You have some very interesting character names, like Mary Bliss and Alan Glazier, which could be Glazier or Glazier.
Oh, I think it was Glazier.
Glazier. Okay.
But, you know, someone pointed out to me, that name is one of the names that I contrived. Many names come to me just in the snap of a finger, and I'm sitting there with my fingers poised over the keyboard. I have a new character, like Walter, who I never thought was going to be that important, so his name didn't seem as if it mattered that much. But Alan, I knew, was going to be an important character, and I decided that since he was a psychotherapist who theoretically, you know, helps people see more clearly, that I would give him this clever last name, Glazier, you know, glassmaker. Well, of course, some reader pointed out to me, well, you know, that's just another version of Glass, which is my own last name. And I thought, you know, another one of these things that the dimwit side of me just didn't happen to notice. And as I said before, you know, that agonizing part of Alan is something I deeply empathize with. I'm not a good decision maker, quite unlike Greeny in that way. And then there are names like Greeny's name that are names that I have stored up for a long time, that I've seen the name in a newspaper article, or I met somebody with that name, and I thought that would be a fabulous name for a character. And I save it for, you know, Fenno's name was the name of a music professor at Yale, where I went as an undergraduate. And I wasn't even a writer then; I was a painter. And my roommate was a music major, and there was this, and I never met this professor, but I thought, wow, what a romantic name. And you know, how many years later? You know, 25 years later, I summoned it up from the depths of my memory, and I used it for that character. And Greeny was the name of a gentleman archaeologist, a man who I never met, but who worked on an expedition for which I did secretarial work as my first job after college. And So names come from different places. You know, some are carefully crafted, some are just a whim or an impulse.
Well, we touched upon this, I think, a little bit earlier than we got off on a tangent, but it's actually a question about your tangential sort of approach to writing, and that is, what do you do to sort of outline these stories? Or I was reading this book, and like all of a sudden there would be this backstory that would pop within the actual narrative, and I'd be like, ooh, wow, okay, you know. Is this backstory sort of planned all in advance, or do you actually work out the backstory as you're writing the fiction, or how does this come about? I mean, how much of a planner are you, and how much of a sort of writing on instinct writer are you?
You know, I'm 90% the, you know, instinct, right from instinct, but I always write from character. And I don't outline novels, but the way I see the two novels I've written is that they're structured somewhat like trees, or they grow like trees. The main character is like the trunk of the tree, and from that character sprout other characters, and from those characters sprout other characters. So you have Greeny, and then immediately you have her husband, you have her son. From her husband you actually have the man Jerry, who was his therapist, who comes in for all of two pages in person, but is, you know, part of the backstory for him. You then you have the governor of New Mexico, and out of him you have Mary Bliss, his sort of right hand, his gal Friday, and so forth. So rather than outlining chapters, I view the characters in terms of their forward motion into the future, but also in terms of their backstory. And I think that actually comes from years of being in psychotherapy, because I call it the psychotherapeutic rhythm of fiction. It's like you're sitting in the couch and you're talking about the traumas of your week, or you're talking about your dreams, you know, but you're talking about something in the present moment. You're probably whining or ranting, and then the therapist asks you, well, so whose voice does that remind you of? Or have you ever experienced anything like that before? And then you think for a minute and you say, well, you know, when I was 10 years old, my mother made me go to my room because I was accused by my sister of doing this and such, and I never did it. And or you remember an old boyfriend who did you wrong, or you remember a professor who intimidated you in a class. And that leads to a whole mini narrative that's a chain of events probing back into the past. Now I can really, and then you return to the present again. So it's sort of like, you know, two steps forward, one step back, and so forth. And I just write that way by instinct. But I have to be careful, because I'm a person who can, as you can probably see from interviewing me, can go off on tangents very easily, and I can do it when I'm writing fiction. And for instance, the character of Walter, for some reason, his whole past, his childhood, his being raised by this very proper German grandmother was so interesting to me that I had a whole kind of mini novel going on about that grandmother and his relationship to his brother when they were younger. And a lot of that I had to edit out at the end. I mean, if I have a tendency towards some kind of excess, it's probably excess of flashback. That's my disease as a fiction writer. But past is, you know, when you write about family, and family to me is the core of all the important drama in the world. I think all larger world strife, you know, you can probably boil down to animosities between families or within families. And when you write about family, you've got to be writing about the past as well as the future. I mean, when we think about our families, the families we were born into, you know, it takes us very far back in the past, and it takes us to stories we've been told about ancestors we never even met. And when you become a parent, you know, like it or not, you revisit your past. You hear the echoes of the things your parents said to you. I mean, this is all, you know, psychology 101, right? Yeah. But I'm very sensitive to that, and you know, nobody is more fascinated by my friends' family stories than I am. And not because I want to use them for my fiction, but just because they're utterly, you know, endlessly fascinating dramas to me.
It's interesting, though, in light of Saga, who is almost the exact opposite of it, that she doesn't actually have access to her complete
That's
memories.
Right.
Was this an exercise for you to control your excess? Was this the whole, one of the motivations behind
putting
the character?
Well, on the other hand, you know, you're right. Her memory has been curtailed, but it means she's obsessed with her memory. Yeah. And she asks at one point, you know, when she reflects that the doctors have told her that her long-term memory, you know, is in place, basically, and that the problems she has are with retaining short-term memory. She reflects on the question, well, how can anybody know what she used to remember? How do they know that she has all her long-term memories? But what might be omitted there? They've led her to believe that she can remember everything before the accident that she had, but maybe that's not true. And, you know, I hate to admit this, but I think in some ways I created that character initially because I thought, I'm going to really face head on the way in which I write about memory by creating a character for whom memory is the most important theme in her life. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, you can create a character for some thematic purpose and they're going to mutate into something else. So there were moments when I felt, when I was writing Saga, and in a way, in a similar fashion to the way I talked about writing about the events of September 11th, writing about this character required intense attention. It didn't come naturally to me the way that writing about Walter for some reason did. Walter was, you know, I was just coasting when I was writing about him. I could just write forever, and I could just, you know, it was a sumptuous experience for me to write Walter. But writing Saga meant that I had to, you know, just be very conscious, not to pun on the subject matter here, but very conscious of how someone whose life was limited in that way would see the world, would see her own life, would see her revised relationships with the people around her, because something like that changes all your relationships. And I decided to stick with her. I thought, sometimes this is too much for me. I have to do away with this character, but I couldn't. And it's been very interesting to me as I go around doing readings how many readers just fell in love with this character. I've now got readers saying, well, so is Saga coming back in the next novel? And I'm like, well, wait a sec. And of course, once again, I don't plan to bring any characters back, but you never know.
Well, she also shares something in common with Greeny in the sense that she has a nickname that she goes by.
That's right.
So were these kinds of, I mean, there's a theme throughout this book of, like, you know, how unplanned circumstances or unnamed circumstances, perhaps things that we can't see, actually impact lives in very sort of significant ways. It was this kind of an effort to play off of that theme by naming these two characters something that they're...
You know, once again, here's Dimwit Julie again. I didn't see till fairly late that I had these two main characters who in their present lives go by names quite unlike their real names. I mean, Greeny's real name is Charlotte, yeah, and Saga's real name is Emily. And I thought, what am I doing here? You know, something's going on. And I think there's even a third character. I can't think who off the bat. But you know, I thought, well, obviously what I'm writing about is who are we at different points in our lives? There's a riff in the very close to the beginning of the book about how Greeny has had a series of names throughout her life, and she, and when she gets a phone call or a piece of mail, she can tell what time in her life the person comes from by what they address her as. She was called Duke by her college roommate from Duquette, her surname. And so it's a question of who we are to different people in our lives and who we want to be. You know, Saga has clearly embraced this nickname that she acquired as a very small child. Greeny's nickname Greeny was invented by her husband. Yeah. And that's very important to me too, because she reflects on how in a romantic way she became his bride when he came up with this new nickname for her.
There's also something vaguely patriarchal about that notion of, like, oh, the little wife, oh, Greeny, you know? I mean, there is...
He
comes up with the name Greeny as if, like, it's like, you know, oh, my teeny weeny kind of wife, or I don't know.
Oh,
I
you mean, think Greeny? See, I
Well,
was,
Greeny is like, it's sort of...
Teeny,
it's
I never
sort,
thought of that. You know, the governor calls her Queenie at yeah. when he meets her, but which I thought, that's what I thought of was, yeah. you know, the queen, you know, but... I don't know. You know, again, you know, I came up with the name Greeny before I came up with her real name, which is, you know, Charlotte Greenaway Duquette. So he comes up with that name from her middle name yeah. in searching for a new name for her, because she won't let him call her Charlotte yeah. because that's a name that she's only called by her immediate family, and he doesn't like Duke. So she lets him make up this name. I don't think he imposes it on her. So I don't think it's patriarchal. I think it's very romantic, actually. You know, it's funny. I mean, I will confess that this detail comes from my parents yeah. because my mother grew up with the name Florence, which she never really loved. And she is called Florence by her older siblings and by all my first cousins. She's Aunt Florence. But she was called, her last name was Macaro, and I think that she was called Mac in college. And I think that my father didn't like that name. Now, again, this is sort of like family folklore, and I've never checked in on this story, but I think it's one I was told when I was very young. So my father invented the name Carrie, which came from Macaro. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess this is kind of a small homage to my parents also. And this is the first time I've actually made that confession, but Saga was something else entirely, and but I think it does represent this entirely new life that she's been forced to lead, you know, since losing so much of what binds her to life. I mean, memory is what binds us to our psychological lives. I mean, we have to be bound materially to the world, but without memory, you know, what are we? And without memory, how would there be fiction?
Sure. Oh, actually, I wanted to give you a response to respond. This is, we were talking about the propagation of certain sort of motifs throughout the book, and Lorraine Adams in the New York Times Book Review complained about the novel's pet population and the frequent cakes, noting that it kind of came at the expense of Alan and Greeny's crumbling marriage. Maybe I'll put the question to you. I mean, I don't think we actually sort of figured an exact answer about why there are so many dogs, why there are so many cakes, and was this just a way for you to kind of absolutely pinpoint the kind of themes of the arcs of the characters? Or
this is a very sensual novel.
Yeah.
The cakes are Greeny's passion, and she is the heart of this novel. And I love fiction where you are really immersed in the working world of the characters. There are novels you can read where you hardly even know what characters do for a living, and they may be fine novels, but work is so much a part of who we are in this world. We talk about our work. I mean, we live in a society where people ask, what do you do when you go to a party? I know that's rude in some other civilized cultures, but that's the fact of our lives now and our identities. So, you know, I don't think there are too many cakes at all. The climax of the novel is arguably the making of a wedding cake. And in that cake, there's actually a lot of metaphorical material. So I don't think there are too many cakes in this book. I think Lorraine Adams was on a diet and resented having to read about too much cake, and I don't think she's experienced the pleasure of living with a dog. But that aside, yes, there are a lot of animals. What can I say? You know, Saga is someone whose one true purpose in her curtailed life is the rescuing of dogs. And so dogs are a part of this book, too. You know, you don't like dogs or cakes, don't read the book. I don't know how to answer that, really. But again, to go back to what I was saying about the world in my fiction, it's very, very full. It's full of details about setting. It's full of odor and flavor and color. And, you know, I did start out my adult life as a painter. That's what I did for many years. And I was a figurative painter. I looked a lot at the world around me. I loved working with color. I probably miss that more than anything else about painting. I miss just having my hands covered with colorful paint. And I am probably, you know, I've been called a maximalist as opposed to a minimalist. And I embrace that mantle fully. You know, my books are as full of stuff as my heart is full of emotions and my soul is full of conflicting yearnings. I don't know how else to defend what I do, but it's not to everyone's taste.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, the worlds that I create are fully sketched in, fully dimensional.
Well, Julia, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you,
Andy. Wait a minute, something's going wrong. Someone's on the phone. 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. Talking about how she can make it right, yeah. Happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. There's nothing wrong being in love with someone, yeah.